She showed them a small sketch of a ragged puppy next to the signature.
You wouldn't know that this was because he called me Nora Inu. Nora means stray, you see, in Japanese. And he thought this was wonderful, that I was a stray who'd found my way across the ocean. Nora Inu is stray dog. That sounds like an insult, I suppose, but it wasn't.
Amazing, Yale said, and he met Bill's exuberant eyes. Details like that, I think, will help a great deal with authentication. Maybe we could record you, what you're saying.
Well, yes, someone should be taking it all down. Isn't that what you're for?
This was directed at Roman. I have a notebook in the car, he said helplessly. Then when they all kept looking at him, he bounded from the room to fetch it.
Well, Nora said, my point is you're going to need these stories, and I don't see how we're going to do that if you take this all back to Chicago. And I'm going to want to sort things, too. I can see now they're out of order. Couldn't you stay up here a week or so?
But they couldn't. Not right now. They had meetings. They had a gallery to run. Plus, as soon as the papers were signed, they wanted to get the art away from Frank. They hit on the idea that Roman could take the shoebox to the public library that afternoon, along with a load of dimes and Xerox everything. The originals could remain in Wisconsin for now. Not in the house, though, Yale put in. So much more could happen to them there.
Yes, yes, Nora said.
He didn't need to spell it out. They'd leave it all at the bank. Then next week, Yale and Roman would come back up, help her sort through. When Roman returned, out of breath, Yale felt a knocking on his knee. Knuckles. He understood that he wasn't to jump or ask what Nora wanted. He looked down as subtly as he could at her closed fist. When she raised it slightly, he put his palm beneath it. She was passing him something. She let it drop into his hand, and he closed his fingers around a complicated object, metal and pointy. He could feel a chain, a necklace. He didn't understand, but he shoved it into his trouser pocket, shifted so the sharp part dropped next to his groin. She said to them all,
"Listen, I feel dandy today, but I don't know how I'll feel next week. And if nothing else, I want you to take this down."
She pointed at Roman.
"Everything I read about Modigliani says he drank himself to death. That's bunk. He died of tuberculosis. The drinking was only to cover up the illness, because there was such a stigma. He'd be at a party and start coughing, and he'd pretend to be falling down drunk and take off. Now, he really was a bit of a drunk. That's why it worked. He was trying to save his dignity. Isn't that funny? I don't think he imagined that decades later people would still be saying he drank himself to death. It makes me terribly angry. Did you write that down?"
Roman read from his notebook. "Modigliani died of tuberculosis, not alcohol."
"Huh. Well, you missed a bit. Next time, a tape recorder. Now, I need to tell you about Ranko, because you won't find anything in a book."
But the teller was back at the door. She said, "There's a man here who'd like permission to join your party." Yale stood. His adrenal glands did strange and unwelcome things. But the man stepping into the room was not Frank. It was someone Yale had never seen before. A tall, older black man brushing snow from his trench coat and looking horribly peeved.
"Herbert," Bill said,
and rose to shake his hand. A big, manly shake. Then while everyone was turned that way, Nora tapped Yale's arm.
"For Fiona," she said.
"The necklace." Yale nodded and rose to greet Herbert Snow. "This is our general counsel," he said to everyone, to himself, to the universe. Yale and Bill and Roman whooped and sang all the way back to Egg Harbor. At the inn, Yale called Charlie.
"That's good," Charlie said. "I'm really happy for you."
"You're really happy for me? Come on, this is huge. That's like what you say when you see your ex on the street. Oh, you have a new boyfriend, you lost weight, I'm really happy for you. This is a huge thing. Like, the art is literally in Bill's room. I'm taking you out to dinner. Tomorrow, because we have to stay one more night. We have Xeroxing to do, and the rows are bad. Where do you want to go? For dinner?"
I'll think about it."
There was a pause, and then Charlie said,
"I really am happy for you. I'm just tired."
Yale almost said something then about the house, about how there was this house he'd been wanting Charlie to visit, and this was the sign, this was the right time. But that could wait. He'd bring it up tomorrow, when they'd had some wine. He called Fiona next, and she shrieked gratifyingly. He told her he had something for her, told her to come by the gallery to see the art. She said,
"Oh, Yale, this was supposed to happen, don't you think?"
On the ride back the next morning, art packed and padded in the trunk, sheaves of Xeroxes on the back seat, papers signed and dated and witnessed, the three of them talked at full speed. "I do feel bad for the family," Yale said. "We're not terrible people, are we?" Bill said, "That man would take the pieces to the wrong restorers, the wrong appraisers. He'd get ripped off, and nothing would ever get authenticated, let alone into the catalogs. A lot of the world's great art has been lost thanks to folks exactly like Frank."
"And this will make the gallery," Yale said. "I mean, I'm sorry, the gallery's already in tremendous shape."
Bill laughed to reassure him. "But we don't yet have four Modiglianis." Roman spoke from the middle of the back seat.
"This is a hell of a first week."
It hit Yale halfway home. If Nora weren't donating everything, she might well have willed a piece to Fiona. A single sketch could have paid Fiona's way to college. And certainly Fiona knew it. And she'd never said a thing. 2015. When Fiona got back to Richards, Jake Austin was on the couch talking to Serge. She wanted to be angry at the invasion. She let herself be angry. But maybe she was a little relieved, too. No one would ask her yet how her day had gone. Still, she hadn't imagined this guy would embed himself. His eyes were red. His shirt undone one button too low. She put her purse on the counter, slid her shoes off. Both men waved, and Jake pointed dramatically to his phone, which lay on the coffee table. He was recording. Fiona made herself tea as quietly as she could. Serge was saying,
"He finds the space between the action and the resting. He doesn't want the photo of action, and he doesn't want the photo of rest, okay?"
"Yes?"
"He looks for the moment between."
Fiona was unclear about whether Serge worked as a publicist for anyone else anymore, or if giving interviews about Richard had become his life. Jake tapped his phone, and the two men relaxed.
"How'd it go?" Jake said.
They filled me in. I hope you don't mind. Is everything okay?"
"Christ," she said. "I don't know."
Well, there went her little fantasy of looking like a normal person on a normal trip. Poof. Fiona hadn't had dinner yet, but she wanted to go straight to bed. She should call Damien, though, and not forget to ask after Karen with something like concern. She ought to call Cecily and tell her that, yes, Kurt was definitely in Paris, even if Cecily wouldn't want to hear it. Or maybe it could wait. Was it even Fiona's responsibility to tell her? She'd always had a bad sense of who fell under her jurisdiction and who didn't. Cecily had known why she was coming here, wished her the best. Fiona hadn't told her, though, about the little girl in the video. Why do that when nothing was certain? She said, "I think I'm done for the day."
"This is perfect," Sarah said, "because you can come to the party. I convinced Jake to join already."
"Party?"
"At Corinne's, remember? We take the metro to Vincennes at 7, okay? We get you home early, don't worry."
"Oh, I... lots of important artists there.
And you need to meet Corinne's husband. You need to see his beard."
"His beard?" Serge laughed.
"Trust me. Just trust."
Fiona called Damien from her room, and he wanted every detail repeated 3 times. It sounded less hopeless in the retelling, more like progress.
"This is great," he said. "This is huge."
She pretended, for his benefit, that she believed him. Karen's radiation started on Monday. Otherwise, he'd hop on a plane. He hoped she knew that.
"I haven't been to Paris since that conference in 94, he said.
"And you left me home with a baby. I never forgave you." But she knew he could hear her smiling.
"I don't know what to do with myself," she said.
She told him about the party.
"Go," he said. "You get to hang out with artists in Paris. Go and have a good time."
"It's not exactly hanging out with artists," she said. "We're not sketching at the cafe." He said,
"Listen, try to retrace your great-aunt's steps while you're there. Didn't you always want to? What about her boyfriend, the dead one?
Ranko Novak?
Try to track him down."
"What, his grave?"
"I don't know. Sure."
"You're sweet, Damien. Go to the party. And then, ciao." Which was something she used to find charming, back when he was her professor and she didn't know better. Well, getting ready for a party was an excuse not to call Cecily. And she really didn't have it in her to call Cecily yet. Fiona wished Jake weren't with them, weren't holding the metro bar with 2 fingers and looking down at her. Richard and Serge sat behind her speaking rapid French, so Fiona had no one to talk to but Jake, and no way to talk to him but quasi-flirtatiously. The one dress she'd brought, a pale blue wrap, was low-cut, and although she had a light coat, the buttons were broken and it hung open. Jake was staring straight down her cleavage. When they disembarked in Vincennes and walked through the dark, quiet streets, past shops and restaurants, and then beautiful, narrow houses, Jake got close to her ear and said,
"So is this the Evanston of Paris?"
And she couldn't help laughing. She stopped herself, though, so he wouldn't think he'd earned it. He smelled of gin, and she wondered if he'd been drinking at Richard's or before. She checked her phone, although she'd checked it 2 minutes ago when the ringer was on. And there was no reason Arno would be calling yet. But she couldn't help refreshing her email, clicking on her empty voicemail. It struck her that she could get rid of Jake by fucking him. It would be fun. She'd get it out of her system, and then he'd do the inevitable and graciously disappear. If he lingered, if he showed up tomorrow, she could always pretend she was in love, ask when they could see each other back in Chicago. "You know," she could say if the situation got desperate, "there's a chance I'm still fertile." Would he even be able to perform, drunk as she assumed he was? He held each syllable a bit too long. "Check out that moon." Held her gaze too long, moved his feet too slowly. Not enough for Richard or Serge to notice, apparently, but enough to irritate Fiona. Why was he allowed to go through life drunk? Why was he allowed his boomerang wallet? And then she was stuck with him at the damn party. Both of them hung by Richard and Serge in the entryway at first, where Corinne, in a yellow tunic dress and a necklace of enormous wooden beads, greeted them warmly, made sure they had drinks, beckoned her husband from the next room. Fernand Leclerc's beard was, as Serge had promised, prodigious. Chest length, as snowy and curled as the beard on a claymation Santa. Importance radiated off him, a buzz that filled the foyer.
"Feel free to look around," he said.
And she couldn't figure out why she'd need or want such an invitation, until she realized the house was filled with incredible art, that guests were sticking their necks into corners and back halls, and even upstairs to glimpse Fernand and Karine's acquisitions. A Basquiat hung outside the bathroom. A Julian Schnabel plate portrait dominated the dining room. People made an effort to speak English to her at first. Karine, Serge, the German writer they introduced her to. But soon everything was a whirl of French, and she was left talking to Jake. They wound up in a sunroom at the back of the house, a room that filled and then emptied every few minutes, as guests popped in to make sure they hadn't missed any trays of food, buckets of champagne, seminal works of cubism. He said, "I've been studying his work online. Richards. It's weird how many photos I didn't even know were his. Like famous ones. That triptych thing. I've totally admired that before. No idea it was Campo. And I saw one of you, I think. Yeah?" Despite the drink in his hand, he seemed soberer now than he had on the metro. She wanted him to disappear. "Was I wearing a flowery dress?"
No, you were next to a guy. You were curled up next to someone in a hospital bed.
Fiona attempted to drain her champagne, although it hurt her nose when she swallowed. "You're asking about private things," she said. "It's art. But I was there. Those were my friends.
I actually didn't ask anything. I don't think I asked a question."
"Fair enough.
What were you afraid I was going to ask?"
She thought.
"You were going to ask me who that was in the bed. Hey, do you want to sit down?"
"No." She looked at the group hovering in the sunroom door, but they were speaking French and hadn't glanced her way.
Listen, I just have one question, and it's not about that picture, it's about the triptych."
"Christ."
"What?" Sorry, let's find food."
She was stressed about things that had nothing to do with Jake Austin and his invasion, but he was a convenient punching bag. And so she stepped too close to him, spoke too loud.
"That was Julian Ames, in the triptych. He was a beautiful person, an actor, and Richard took the first photo when everything was great. Then he took the second when Julian was freaking out because he knew he was sick, and then he took the third when he weighed like 100 pounds.
"Hey, I'm sorry, my brother died in this stupid hospital where my parents put him. This place where everyone was scared of him and no one knew what the hell they were doing. And Julian came up there every single day. He wasn't the smartest guy, but he was loyal and he felt things more than other people. You numb out with alcohol, right? Some people actually feel things. And there was this nurse who'd come around with the menu, but she wouldn't bring it into the room. Not that he could eat anything anyway."
"That's awful."
"Shut up. So half the time it didn't matter because Nico was out of it. What we realized at the very end was he had lymphoma of the central nervous system. And these idiot doctors missed it and gave him steroids, which was the worst thing. But it reduced the brain swelling at first. So for a couple days he had these lucid windows. He'd reemerge for 10 minutes and then he'd be gone again. So he's lucid one day and the nurse comes and stands there. And she's got this smug little face. And she starts reading the menu from the doorway. Julian's in there with me, and Nico's alert. And the nurse goes, 'Spaghetti with meatballs.' So Julian stands at the foot of Nico's bed and repeats it in this theater voice, like he's playing a Shakespearean king. And then he does, it was somewhere between pantomime and an interpretive dance, this whole thing about spaghetti.
twining it around his fork, slurping the noodles. And the nurse just has this look on her face like, this is why you're all sick. Look at this faggy behavior. Julian goes right up and peers over her shoulder at the menu, and he announces the next thing, which is chicken salad. And he does a chicken dance. He does the whole menu like that while the nurse stands there.
That's awesome.
No, it was sad and awful. It was the last time my brother was awake.
Can I ask what happened to him? To Julian?
What the fuck do you think happened?
Fiona, you're...
He was an actor with no family and no health insurance. And he could have gotten some decent support at least if he'd stayed in Chicago. If he'd stuck around till the drugs came out. But instead he took off and died alone and I don't even know where.
You're bleeding.
What?
Your hand.
She looked down. The empty champagne flute, which she'd been holding tightly, was cracked. A droplet of blood ran down her right wrist, and another ran down the outside of the glass. When she peeled her hand back, the whole glass fell apart, shattering onto the floor. The room went gray at the edges, and voices closed in. Corinne was there, holding a towel under her hand, guiding her to a wallpapered little bathroom with golden faucets, sitting her on the closed toilet. Now Corinne's husband was kneeling in front of Fiona with a pair of tweezers, slowly picking out the shards embedded all over her palm.
I'm so embarrassed, she said when everything was back in focus,
when Corinne had left to clean up the mess.
This is not allowed.
His voice was phlegmy and deep. There was something regal about the top of his bent head, his gel-combed white hair. Fernand, she reminded herself. Fernand, the important critic. Nothing here was recognizable as her own life. This man, this room, this blood. He massaged the meat of her palm gently, peered at her hand through his glasses.
Thank you, she said. Have you done this before?
I'm just finding the beats of light.
Fiona imagined her palm littered with a thousand slivers of reflective glass, one she could carry with her forever. Her whole body ought to be like that. Her skin ought to cut the people who touched it. She wanted to say nice things to him, but didn't want to sit here endlessly repeating her thanks.
Do you paint, too? Besides the critic stuff? Your hands are so steady.
I studied painting.
He looked up and smiled, and she felt she could stay in the bathroom forever, being taken care of.
Terrible idea. Critics shouldn't know how to paint.
Jake appeared in the doorway. She didn't have the energy to send him away. Fernand daubed more antiseptic on her skin with a flat circle of cotton. He said,
I attended the Académie des Beaux-Arts. Very old-fashioned.
Fiona perked up.
Are you still there? Do you teach?
No.
He laughed.
Not for me.
She stopped while he dug into the base of her middle finger with a tweezer point. My family's always been trying to track down this one artist who was there. He was my great-aunt's boyfriend, and he died young.
What year?
Oh, way before your time. I didn't mean you'd know him. I don't even know why I'm asking. I'm a little woozy. He won the Prix de Rome, but then he died right after World War I.
Yes, that's before my time.
His name was Renko Novak. We were just always curious.
You're trying to find what? Records? A picture?
He turned to where Jake still hovered.
Do you have a light on your phone?
Jake turned on his phone's flashlight and, grimacing, held it above Fiona's palm.
I tell you what, Fernand said. I have a friend there. You write the name down before you leave tonight. I'll ask him.
That's so kind.
Well, you nearly severed your fingers at our house. This is so you won't sue.
Fiona held a glass of water in her gauzed hand because it felt good, even if the condensation made the gauze wet. She'd found Richard in the dining room, holding cord over platters of smoked fish. She could barely follow the conversation, and only thanks to Richard's occasional translation. Marie is his wife. This was the Gary retrospective last year. She's talking about her daughter's work. Fiona wanted codeine. She wanted to find a pharmacy. And then what? Maybe walk around the Marais till morning. Richard said to her, Paul here was asking how fame changed me. I'm explaining that I've only been famous a quarter of my life. Such a short time. And then he spoke French again to this Paul, who had a giraffe neck and tiny teeth. Back to Fiona.
I was saying that my very first patron was a collector named Esme Sharp. Do you remember her? And she just emailed last week asking for a first look at some stuff before Art Basel this spring. Nothing changes. I'm still making work for the same audience.
Jake had disappeared, but now he was back, lingering outside the circle. He rolled up his sleeves. His arms were all muscle and vein. At his left elbow, the bottom of a tattoo. The name was a distant bell to Fiona. Esme Sharp. Someone circling Richard when his career took off. Someone she might have met when she was driving back to Chicago from Madison on weekends. Pregnant or with a newborn Claire. Or maybe she'd met her after they'd moved back to the city in 93. Damien teaching at U of C and Fiona going out of her mind. Bored to death in the place she'd once found endlessly vibrant. The early 90s were a haze. Claire had been born in the summer of 92, and Fiona was in the throes of what anyone today would easily spot as extended postpartum depression, on top of the PTSD she'd carried with her from the 80s. She'd lied to her doctor that everything was splendid, and he hadn't pushed further. She tried taking graduate classes at DePaul, but couldn't bring herself to complete a single paper. She watched morning television, interviews with celebrities whose names she didn't know. She sat on benches while Claire circled playgrounds and dug her fat fingers into cold sandboxes and got herself stuck on top of slides. It wasn't until Claire started preschool and Fiona began working for the resale shop, around the time Richard left for Paris, that everything came clear. It was as if someone had handed her new glasses around 1995, turned up the color, unmuted the city. Just in time for Fiona to realize how unhappy she was with Damien. His little lectures, his teeth licking. She began fucking a man she met at yoga for the love of God. And even as it slowly eroded her marriage, it helped her wake up. But by then Richard was gone. Esme must have been from that lost time. A boat in a foggy harbor.
Et qu'est-ce que vous faites dans la vie?
A woman asked Fiona. She said,
J'ai une boutique en Chicago.
God, she wanted to leave. Richard rescued her, talking quickly. She assumed he was disabusing the crowd of the notion that Fiona sold fancy shoes. She heard, Le Sida, which she'd always found a prettier acronym than AIDS. Well, everything about AIDS had been better all along in France, in London, even in Canada. Less shame, more education, more funding, more research. Fewer people screaming about hell as you died. She sidled up to Jake and whispered, Help me find more gauze, she said. You want me to ask the hosts?
No, just come with me.
If she could ride around on a scooter like a teenager, she could act like one in other ways, too. He followed her into the front hall, empty but for the coat tree. She said,
You don't happen to have any good pain meds on you?
I wish.
Do you have a cigarette?
No, but I could use one.
Do you have a condom?
A what?
Listen.
She checked her phone. Nothing. She dug her coat out from under the others.
You're drunk, right?
Not really.
He followed her out the door. The streets were empty.
Do you think you're sober enough to find the metro again?
She turned left, although she wasn't sure that was the way. I said I'm not drunk. I was a little stoned when we got here, but it wore off.
You're a shoddy alcoholic. Not even drunk.
She walked fast, and he worked to keep up.
Who said I was an alcoholic? Some guy on a plane.
They stopped at an intersection and waited for the crossing light, although the streets were empty.
You're what? She said. 30?
35.
Why? I don't want to sleep with an infant. 35 should work.
It was clear from his face that he couldn't tell if she was joking, and also clear that he wanted her not to be. She'd had the wrong amount of wine for self-analysis. One more glass and she might be sitting on the sidewalk, spilling her life secrets, wondering aloud why she tended to weaponize sex. One less glass and she'd still be next to Richard, nodding along to a French conversation. As things stood, she'd had just enough to be aware of how narrowly she'd missed both these possibilities, and also just enough not to care. She was drunk enough to want a man on top of her, but not so drunk that she'd fall asleep as soon as she was horizontal. Once they'd crossed the street, she put her hand on Jake's ass, slid her fingers into his back pocket. He swung toward her and gave her a look, some combination of vulnerable and predatory, and then he cupped the base of her skull, pulled her mouth onto his, and her tongue toward his, and her pelvis toward his. They walked another block, and he did it again, and then another block, and he did it again. He smelled like smoked meat, which was not something she minded. They made their way to a pharmacy for condoms and ibuprofen, and then back to Richard's house. And in her crisp guest bed, they had sex. Fiona remembered only once, riding on top of him, that she was most likely someone's grandmother now. Mostly, she felt no self-consciousness at all. Jake was so beautiful. The skin of his upper arms taut and goose-bumped, that it was easy to be lost. She ran her left hand through his chest hair, as thick as his beard, and kept her gauze-wrapped right hand tight on the bed frame. It would hurt worse in the morning, but she didn't care. Jake finished with a long, helpless caveman grunt, and then he lay next to her and slipped his fingers between her thighs, which she didn't think would work, until it did. She imagined Jake would go to sleep afterward. But instead he propped himself up on one elbow and told her about his first college girlfriend, a woman who tied him to the bed and left him there an hour, which was something he thought about all the time, and he hated her for it. But it was also the reason he still wasn't over her. Pillow talk. Good God. Fiona wanted to kick him out, but it was only 9:30, and she couldn't imagine Richard and Serge returning for a couple more hours. She'd need him gone before noon. Not that Richard would judge her, but he wouldn't pass up the opportunity to tease her either. And she was 51, and she didn't quite believe Jake was 35. And she couldn't bear for the age difference to be a topic of prurient interest. Jake said, "Tell me about your first."
"What?" she said. "Are we bonding?"
He laughed, not hurt. "This is one of the best parts. It's like there's foreplay and there's afterplay." She rolled toward him. "What the hell?"
"I lost my virginity to my cousin's science teacher. I'd already graduated high school, just barely. Different school."
"Damn."
"I don't know. All my friends were much older. They were my brother's friends. And then they were mine. It was hard to get excited about someone with acne."
"Did you ever sleep with your brother's friends?" The laugh that escaped her was embarrassingly goose-like. The idea of her younger self with Charlie Keene or Asher Glass. She'd been madly in love with Yale, but that was different. Without expectation, without hope,
A crush could remain pure and platonic. It was never lustful, never selfish. She was always just looking for excuses to touch him, talk to him, lean her head against his arm.
"Not so much," he said.
"Not so much."
"So, what I don't understand about that triptych, about the guy in the triptych, is that..."
"My God, shut up. Come here."
She tried to kiss him, just to stop him from saying another word, but he pulled back.
"Didn't I already cut my hand over this? You're being kind of... vampiric."
"Sorry," he said. "Sorry, I'm being a journalist. But also, like, isn't it something you should talk about? To process it?"
"I've been processing for 30 years, she said. "I've been processing since you were watching Saturday morning cartoons in your pajamas. I have a shrink for this stuff. I don't need a journalist."
"But you don't have sex with your shrink. I mean, do you? Because, seriously, when you talk after sex, it's different. I think it's why Freud had everyone lie down."
"Did Freud sleep with his patients?"
"I think so."
She rolled her eyes. "Okay, fine. Julian died. God, I don't even know how long ago. You know, depending on how close you were to someone, there were some people who drew you in, leaned on you, and you spent more time with them in those last months than you ever had before. Then there were people where, if you were outside their closest circle, they shut you out. Not in an unkind way, it's just that they didn't need you. You'd have been an interruption, you know? And I wasn't in Julian's tightest circle. And anyway, in the end, he shut everyone out."
Jake looked like he didn't follow. "Okay," he said.
"There was this competitive grieving thing that could happen. People would crowd into the hospital and stand around for days, sort of posturing. That sounds terrible, but it's true. Not that they had bad intentions, just... you always want to believe you're important in someone's life. And sometimes, in the end, it turns out you aren't."
Jake ran his tongue down her ear, and then along her clavicle. "One more time," he said. She didn't like the way he looked at her, staring deep like he was trying to get their pupil dilation synced up. The point had never been for him to get more attached, especially not with everything else going on. There were sounds out in the apartment.
"Shit,"
she said.
"If it's just Richard, he'll go to bed soon. You can sneak out then, okay?"
"All right," he said, and closed his eyes. "I'm not an alcoholic. That was a joke."
"How was that funny?"
"I don't know. I was drunk." Fiona must have fallen asleep, because she was on a bus in Chicago with Richard, looking for Corrine's house. Her hand was on fire. When she rolled over in the middle of the night, Jake, thank God, was gone.
1986. Bill had decreed that everyone had the afternoon off. Yale lugged his bag on the L, and then to Briar, and up the two flights. He'd been away long enough to induce that wonderful coming home after a long trip feeling. The way you're hit with the smells of your own building, the dimensions of your own hallway, which have somehow readjusted themselves so the place feels dreamlike, off by a few vertiginous inches in every direction. He was hungry, late for lunch. He thought he might make a grilled cheese, and he wondered if there was tomato soup in the pantry. When he opened the door, Charlie's mother stood there in a gray dress, her feet bare. He thought she was coming next week. Yale dropped his bag and said, "Teresa," and went to hug her. As he did, he heard the bedroom door shut. He assumed Charlie was coming out to see him, closing the door to hide the unmade bed from his mother. But Charlie didn't appear. He'd gone in, not out. And when he pulled back from Teresa, she had the strangest face. She smiled, but only with her mouth, and she said,
Yale, we need... Shall we go for a walk?
He felt as if the room might tip sideways, or already had.
What happened?
Charlie was having a breakdown. Julian had died. The paper had folded. Reagan had... Teresa put her hands on his arms. He still had his coat on, his dressy coat.
Yale, we ought to take a walk.
Why would I want to do that? Teresa, what the hell? Her eyes were filling, and he saw now that she'd already been crying, that her face was a mess. Her hair was a mess. He put his hands into his coat pockets. Fiona's necklace was there, transferred from his pants, and the wing stabbed his palm. It was a cameo with birds on each side, birds holding up the frame of the cameo. Sharp metal wings. Something was very wrong. Teresa drew a breath and very quietly said,
Yale, I'm going to walk you to the clinic, and we're going to get you tested.
Yale started to say, I can't believe he's doing this again. I can't believe you're listening to him. I can't believe he thinks I'd do that to him. And we just got tested this spring. But he sat on the floor and put his head between his knees. She was trying to tell him something different. Something about Charlie. And Yale couldn't work out the pieces. But yes, oh God, he understood. Needles shot through his arms and legs and abdomen, pinned him to the moment. A dead bug on a foam square. He could hear Charlie in the bedroom, walking, moving things. Yale squeezed his ears with his knees. Teresa had crouched in front of him. She put her hand on his shoe. Nico's shoe. She said,
Yale, can you hear me?
Yale was shocked to find that he wasn't crying, even though Teresa was. Why was he not crying? He whispered, Teresa, what did he do?
I don't know.
She shook her head.
He won't tell me. Listen, Yale, even if he has these antibodies, that just means he's been exposed. It doesn't mean he has the virus.
That's not true. He knows damn well that's not true. Did he tell you that? His compulsion to whisper might have come from practice, not discussing someone's disease when the guy was within earshot. Or maybe he wanted to deny Charlie his reaction. He could have screamed, couldn't he? He could have broken down the bedroom door and held him, or punched him, instead of sitting here thinking about his own body, his own health, his own heart. He might vomit. He wanted to vomit. If Charlie were out here saying all this himself, he could think about Charlie, about what this meant for him. But all he had was a closed door, and this message, this messenger. What the hell had happened? He looked at the ceiling, which was still, improbably, just a plain white ceiling. He said, When did he call you? When did you come?
He got the results yesterday. I flew in this morning.
Today was the 16th. So Charlie would have gotten tested what, the very beginning of the month? The very end of December? And Yale was on his feet, hurtling toward the bedroom.
Charlie, did you fucking sleep with Julian? With Julian? What the hell did you do, Charlie? What the fuck is wrong with you?
He kicked the door, and he kicked it again. It hurt his foot, but not enough. Those were the dominoes that had fallen. Julian, and then Charlie. And maybe Yale. Charlie going pale at lunch. Charlie at the payphone. Charlie walking around the city on New Year's Eve while Yale visited the hospital alone. When Yale took too much of his inhaler, his hands would buzz and tingle. They did this now, and they were hot. Teresa pulled him back by the waist, and he heard sobbing through the locked door. She said,
We need to get you out of here, Yale. You don't have to get tested right now. We can just go to a pub, a friend's flat.
Julian skipping out on Thanksgiving. Charlie not wanting to see Hamlet. Charlie grilling Yale. What did Julian say? What did Julian do? Every time he mentioned seeing him. He wheeled on her.
It would do me zero good to get tested right now. Do you understand?
He was shouting, so Charlie would hear.
It takes 3 months to be sure. You have to wait 3 months from the last time you were exposed.
But you might feel better,
she said weakly. When was the last time they'd had sex? There was the blowjob on Saturday. But when was the last time Charlie had so much as removed his own pants? Let Yale unbuckle his belt? God, not since New Year's. Yale had to give him that much credit. He'd pushed him away again and again. But before that, yes. Christmas, etc. And Lord knew when he'd slept with Julian, how many times, over how many weeks or years. He shouted, close enough to the door that he could feel his own breath bounce back and hit him in the face.
How long were you doing this, Charlie? Is this why you were so paranoid? Because you were looking in the goddamned mirror?
Honey, stop,
Teresa said. He shouldn't have said any of this in front of her, but he didn't care.
You at least could have let Teddy fuck you, Yale shouted. He's not sick!
Something crashed into the door. Teresa said,
Yale, stop!
Then he had to listen to her. Her son was dying. Charlie was dying. He sank to the floor again and put his head between his knees again. He thought about getting up again and kicking furniture, but no, he was going to stay here and breathe. This wasn't about Yale. At least not yet. When they got tested together in the spring, Yale had imagined that if they were infected, they'd hold each other and sob, and then they'd go out for a good meal and make jokes about fattening up. And they'd order the most expensive bottle of wine, and it would be a terrible night. But they'd be heading into this together. Dr. Vincent had counseled them, together, before their tests. Let's discuss what a positive diagnosis would mean for you, he'd said. And he'd explained that these things went better if you thought through your reaction, your options, ahead of time, and with a clear mind. He said, who would you turn to for support? They pointed to each other. Charlie had said, and we have a tight circle of friends. And my mother. Yale felt all those people falling away right now like dust. If he didn't have Charlie, he didn't have Teresa. And he didn't have their friends, who'd all been Charlie's friends first. He was fairly sure he didn't have Charlie. Apparently, Charlie had Julian instead. And who knew what else Charlie had been up to? He picked up his overnight bag and stuck in a bottle of scotch from the cupboard. He kissed Teresa, missing her face, grazing her ear, then he said, I'm so sorry, he said. I didn't do this to him.
I know, she said.
And then he was out on the street with no idea which way to walk. He wandered to Little Jim's, and sat there staring at the bottles behind the bar, and drank vodka tonics because they were on special. He might have been pounding them down if he felt like moving his arms, which he didn't, despite his heart rate, despite the unhelpful primal signals telling him to scramble up a tree for safety. Porn was showing on the big TV. A guy watched, tentatively, from behind a shower wall as two other men went at it. The camera kept panning back to the voyeur's face. He was never going to join in. It wasn't that kind of movie. Yale felt nothing, watching. Or nothing besides what he already felt. Nausea. Paralysis. He'd torn a little plastic straw to shreds. No one bothered him. Surely they could tell something was wrong. It wasn't the cheating that bothered him most. He articulated this mentally down into his glass, thought it at the melting ice cubes. And it wasn't only the disease, the exposure, although that was most of it. But the thing screwing itself into his heart right now
was that he'd let himself be so cowed by Charlie's demands. He'd been walking on eggshells for this man, and meanwhile Charlie, behind Yale's back, had just been throwing the egg straight at the wall. He felt, more than anything else, stupid. By the time he walked out the door, it was late, past dinner, although the clinic would still be open. But why do that to himself right now? He should wait 3 months. No, 3 months minus... Today was the 16th. 3 months from New Year's. So, the end of March? He couldn't manage the math. The antibodies might show up faster, but that wasn't exactly reassuring. He'd be walking into either a meaningless negative and more purgatory, or a death sentence. He thought about going to the gallery, sleeping on his office floor, but the security guard would freak out. He thought of Terrence, who was home from the hospital. Someone ought to be at Terrence's anyway. He could be the person at Terrence's, the person taking care of Terrence. He walked to Melrose and buzzed. Then he felt awful at the thought of Terrence having to get up to answer. They weren't best friends or anything. He'd been closer to Nico. He had no right to Terrence's energy reserves. He was about to walk away when Terrence said hello. He said, "You can come up, Yale, but I'll be honest, it smells like shit." It did. Terrence's face had hollowed. His skin was shiny and taut. But in the hospital he'd grown a patchy beard, and he hadn't shaved it since. How had his body found the energy to produce hair? Why was it growing a beard instead of T-cells? Roscoe, Nico's old gray cat, rubbed against Yale's leg. "Does he need food?" Yale asked. "No," Terrence said, "but you're welcome to clean his litter." He wasn't joking. "I'm not supposed to do it without rubber gloves, and I ran out. Not supposed to have him here at all, really." The box in the kitchen was disgusting. Yale knelt on the kitchen floor and got to work, with Roscoe headbutting his thigh. Doing this felt right. Yale could spend the rest of the night scooping out dung and islands of dried piss, and it would feel like he was in exactly the correct place. "You know his doctor doesn't want you here," he whispered to Roscoe. "And he's allergic to you, too." Once he was on Terrence's couch, a glass of his own scotch in his hand, he found that he couldn't tell him anything true. He couldn't say, "Charlie's sick," and he couldn't say, "Charlie cheated on me." It was humiliating. And the first part wasn't his news to tell. He couldn't go spreading word that Charlie, who had advocated safe sex and out loud before anyone else, was a hypocrite. Not that most people would see it that way. They'd more likely take Charlie's side, interpret anything Yale said as blame, as vindictiveness. Terrence was in his big green armchair, his cane beside him. He said, "Yale, you okay?" He didn't feel sick, hadn't noticed anything strange. He knew that before he slept tonight, he'd check himself in the mirror for spots, check his lymph nodes, check his throat for thrush. It had been a compulsive nightly ritual before the tests came out, one he'd been free of for less than a year. Now it would be back. But Terrence wasn't asking if he was sick, only if he was about to burst into tears, which in fact he might be. He said, "Charlie just kicked me out. I think we're done." Terrence puffed air through his lips, but he didn't look surprised. He tucked his ratty quilt around his legs. Yale said, "Wait, Terrence, do you know something about this?" "About what?" Terrence was a bad liar. Or maybe he just didn't have the energy. He shouldn't have said it. But he said, "Charlie and Julian." Terrence grimaced and then nodded, slowly. "Does everyone know?" No. It's just that after... Okay. After the memorial... Oh, fuck. After the memorial, when we went to Nico's... He couldn't find you, and he was pissed about something.
and he got drunk. Like, really drunk. Julian was in the bathroom with him, taking care of him. I figured he was puking. But they were in there a long time. I went in to see what was up. And they were, you know, they were at it. And a little later they left together. No one else noticed. I called Julian the next day, and he was torn up. Seriously, it was a one-time deal. Julian wouldn't want to hurt you. Neither would Charlie. I know that. You know that. No way it was one time, Yell said. No way. Things don't work that way. That was the plot of some educational film strip. Not real life. One time is all it takes. Don't even hold hands. You might get syphilis. But could it have been true? Was the universe that horribly vengeful? That precise? Yale was suddenly reeling back to the night of the Howard Brown fundraiser. Dear God, this was what Julian had been trying to convey, standing there by the sinks and staring into Yale's eyes. Julian wasn't in love with him. He was sorry. Maybe he thought Yale knew, or figured he'd find out soon, or maybe he was trying to salve his own conscience. Like an idiot, Yale had been flattered. And right on the heels of those thoughts, Yale was blaming himself, ridiculously, for having gone upstairs at Richard's after the memorial. If he hadn't done that, if he hadn't scared Charlie, maybe none of this would have happened. If it had truly been an isolated thing, then the moment he climbed those stairs, he'd killed Charlie. And maybe himself. Yale let out a shudder that might have been half a sob, and he said, "He's got the virus, Terrence. But you can't tell anyone."
Fuck. Oh, Yale.
Terrence looked like he wanted to get out of his chair. Like if he had the energy, he'd come sit next to him so Yale wouldn't feel so small and alone on the big couch.
I knew about Julian, but I didn't know about Charlie. Somehow it didn't even cross my mind. I don't know. Maybe it was all Charlie's stuff about rubbers, all his safety stuff. Yale, if I'd thought of it, you have to believe me that I'd...
Okay, Yale said.
God.
Look, no one knows, and you can't tell. It was just that stupid test. If it weren't for the test, we wouldn't even know. We'd be out to dinner right now.
Fuck. Yeah, but we need that test, right? You might not get sick because of the test.
I'll know that in 3 months.
Listen, you get the fuck flu? You been sick? Stomach flu, fever? Like you got steamrolled, but the steamroller was full of wolves, and the wolves are made of salmonella?
Not everyone gets that. And like, I was probably sick in the summer, I just can't remember. Maybe I was sick in the spring. Charlie had been under the weather in December. So maybe the whole thing was true. Maybe it had been a one-time lapse. Or maybe the Julian thing had started that night and kept going. Yale's head spun. He said, "It's like the world's worst logic puzzle."
"I'm sorry, Yale."
"Stop it. You're not allowed to feel sorry for me."
"I think I am."
Yale poured himself more scotch. He still hadn't eaten dinner, but he wasn't about to ask Terrence for food. Roscoe jumped up on the couch beside him and fell promptly asleep. Terrence said,
"You can stay here tonight if you want. But believe me, you don't want to stay longer. I'm going to wake you up with my morning sickness."
He rubbed his concave belly and said,
"This baby must be a girl. She's such a drama queen."
Yale said, "Until about 1 o'clock, this was the best day of my life." And although Terrence might well have been hinting that he was ready for bed, he couldn't stop himself from talking. He told Terrence about Nora's artwork, or at least the bare details, Modigliani, etc. It felt now like a tremendously hollow victory. He'd lost his lover and possibly his health, his life. But he'd brought some old drawings from Wisconsin to Illinois. Pieces of paper. He said,
The whole time we were up there, I kept thinking, this is too good to be true. There's something I'm missing. I'm being tricked. Maybe it was my subconscious, you know? I knew inside something was off.